Hi, my name is Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Chefs on the Grill from Chicago Magazine.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Welcome back for another edition of Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill. This month I sit down with Donald Trump's newest culinary apprentice, Chef Frank Brunacci. Brunacci is a Melbourne native who made a name for himself at the now-defunct Victor's Restaurant at the Ritz-Carlton in New Orleans. He's just been tapped to helm the kitchen at the Trump International Hotel and Tower here in Chicago, as well as the in-house restaurant 16, which is slated to open this December. We sit down to talk about his plans, his background, and what it was like to meet the Donald for the first time. Enjoy the interview.
You know, you came here for the job, but what do you think about Chicago? I know you've been in New Orleans. I know
Yeah. You've
been in London. You've been all over, really.
I've been pretty much all over. I am an Aussie boy by nature. I was there since I was 21.
Melbourne, right?
Yeah. And I can honestly say, without saying anything different, that this is the first time in 10 years that I feel like I'm at home for the first time. You know, Midwest mentality, Chicago, the big city, this is what Australia's all about to me. You know what I mean? It's friendly people and it's clean cities. The traffic's a bit of a problem, I guess, but
it's not New York, so
yeah, it's not New York. And you know, if I had to put my hand up, if Trump was opening up in New York, in Chicago, or LA, I would put my hand for Chicago any day of the week.
Have you gotten to eat out a little bit?
I think I've eaten in every restaurant I need to eat in.
Yeah.
And it's been great.
You thoughts? Know. Were you inspired? Was there anything that really just piqued your interest?
There's a big movement in Chicago on the food scene. And I'm not going to say I haven't really done the whole food scene in New York. I've been in a couple of restaurants that have great names over there. But this place is unbelievable. I mean, it really is. I mean, everything is so contemporary and modern. It's the old school, you know, banquettes with the floral patterns and stuff, and the garret. And that's the way of the past. And it's like Chicago's ahead of everybody. You know, I mean, L.A. doesn't have that. L.A. is probably at that same level, I think. But Chicago's incredible. The people are so friendly. The chefs, everyone that I've met, have extended their hand and warmth and friendship and whatever I need to get started. You know, they're more than willing. I haven't started taking any of their cooks yet. So. But, you know, I'll spread it around. I'll spread the love a little bit, you know. So
I think one of the interesting things that you mentioned, you talk about this contemporary nature. Mm-hmm. You know, I know when you were at Victor's at the Ritz-Carlton in New mm-hmm. Orleans, you were kind of, in 2002, you were doing, you know, I think I read shark bacon. Mm-hmm. You were doing olive oil ice cream. Mm-hmm. You were doing a lot of these really cutting edge things,
yeah.
Which, you know, in 2002, that was still pretty new. I mean, outside of like Ferran Adria,
yeah.
You know, you were definitely pushing the envelope.
The New Orleans was a piece of history for me. I went to everywhere I looked in America, you know, because I didn't really know that much. So everything I knew about America, it was always New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. It was the top three. So I go to New Orleans thinking it's going to be this dining capital of America. It's definitely, it's number one for eating capital. It's not a dining destination.
It's the deep fried capital of
yeah,
the world.
Yeah, it is, you know, and I love New Orleans. I mean, I met my wife there, she, you know, fantastic people. I lived in a beautiful house right on the lake. The real estate, everything is fantastic. The problem is I couldn't fill my restaurant. Mm-hmm. I couldn't fill it. And then people would shy away from the... And I think New Orleans was a little bit behind the scenes when I first joined there. And, you know, we wanted to become a five-star, five-dime restaurant. We became five diamonds after 13 months. After I did that, there was really nothing else to achieve. But even with that achievement, we still couldn't fill the restaurant. I don't think we're going to have that problem here. I think people are going to embrace the fact that this is the food, this is the cuisine. They'll embrace me as an individual.
Where'd you come up with the idea for shark bacon?
You know, I didn't make it. It came in from, I think, Austria or Belgium or something. And it's just through the suppliers that you develop these relationships with, and you're like, you want something different. Everybody wants something different to put on the table. And he's like, I've got this shark bacon, this shark belly that's just smoked. And so we called it shark bacon.
Sure.
And it was, you know, contrary to what one of the reporters said about that. I don't know if you read that.
William Grimes, the New York Times, yeah.
Contrary to what he said about it, it wasn't too salty. It went very well with the dish. And I shouldn't say that because he'd probably kill me.
No, I'm sure.
You know, I loved it. I mean, I thought it was fantastic. And it went very well with the Dovasol. And plus, you know, we had this Noilly Pratt broth that really brought it to life. So
he seemed both delighted and sort of confused in that review. Like, he was like, I love half of it. Some of it I'm scared by.
I think a lot of people feel that about me when they first get to meet.
Yeah, I wonder, does it have any impact on you? Do you feel like you need to pull back or do you just keep going?
I got to move forward.
Yeah.
If I move backwards, if I conform, I lose. If I create, I'm winning. And to give you an example, Picasso, if he's out in the street painting a picture and someone comes up and says, oh, that's a beautiful picture. If he had a little red in there, it'd really go well in my living room. If they ask the artist to do that, he'd be like, no, this is the artwork. I'm the chef, this is who I am, this is how I cook. And it's, again, and I don't disagree. I think, I have highs and lows, and I change the menu that often that, sometimes the good thing about changing it that often is the fact that if I don't like it, I can push it away. Maybe that night he had three bad things and three great things.
When does a chef become an artist?
I really think it turned for me right around 27, 28. And I became a chef at 24. When I left London, I became a chef and went back to Australia, but I didn't really cook. You know what I mean? All I did was I created something that had been created before, and I didn't have my own style. I kind of knew all these different things, and I'd put them together. But it was just to replicate what I'd learned before. And, when I went back, when I came to America, I was sous chef again, working for the same chef, Joel, who I worked with in London, and we changed the menu every day. I mean, it was every day.
It was Joel Antunes.
Joel Antunes, and he's at the forefront of marriage of flavor and creating, delicateness and lightness in everything. And so everything that we would change the menu every day, and I was the taster of everything, and it got my mind tweaking, so I could taste things in my mouth without even putting them in there. I mean, I think if I have any talent, it's to do that, And then I think about a dish, and then I create it on the plate, all in my mind, before I even put it in the pan.
Yeah, that's what they say. Like, there's been much made about Grant Achatz at Alinea. He's going through a cancer battle with his tongue, and one of the things he said was this idea that, like, Beethoven wrote his Ninth Symphony while he was deaf, and that chefs very much can compose a plate in their heads in the same way. Tastes are like notes, in a
absolutely.
Way.
Well, if you think about that, that's true. I mean, as long as you know every flavor, it's like a sommelier. A sommelier can taste the wine or knows what the wine is going to taste like. He sees the bottle and says, okay, I know exactly what it's going to taste like, but there's a different balance on there maybe that's going to trigger something in his mind with is going to bring out a different influence of flavor.
Do you remember what the first dish that you really felt like you owned was? If there was even like a turning dish where you're like, this is something I've created, or I'm really proud of, it's new.
I'm going to say The cram salad is something that I do that no matter who tastes it, the palate dances,
Tell me about that.
Well, we take cantaloupe and we slice it. It's super thin. And then we cut it into discs. And then those discs then go into a bombe de Venise with a pink peppercorn spice that I make. So it gets a little heat and a little acidic. So that then masks the mold, and inside the mask will be the Alaskan crab, which is a very sweet textured meat. And we mix that with a little mayonnaise and fresh herbs and some lemon coffee, some lemon oil, and it's just so refreshing and light. And then I reduce pineapple juice to make a dressing, and I dress the microgreens on top of that, and we finish it with a little vanilla oil. And I swear to God, it takes your palate on a journey that you think, my God, this is... If it's not the best thing you've put in your mouth, it's certainly close,
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, just on the flavors and what transpires. But I like elements of surprise, when I'm cooking. I like if there's a puree, it's elements. It's elements and components, and that's really where the cuisine takes me. And then every time I put a dish together, I think of three things, and I say, okay, now I need the surprise, I need the sweetness, and I need the acidity, and then I need the the presentation and the wow factor. So,
one of the things I was reading about, or just seeing a little bit of your proposed breakfast menu, there was like a lobster tostada with poached eggs and béarnaise, and scrambled eggs with smoked bacon and fresh mint with caviar and brioche. one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately is this idea of, like, breakfast is kind of the last frontier. You know, there's everybody, a lot of people have redone dinner and they've redone lunch, mm-hmm. but most people don't give any kind of luxury to breakfast, or they don't, you know, innovate. You know, it's like, it's still kind of poached eggs and that's
right.
it.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of why that is? And it seems like you're actually going to be bringing something to the market that might
be
here.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I think being a father now of two young children, breakfast is the only time I get to spend with my family. And not to say that my kids are eating this sort of stuff, they're not, but this is the only time I can go to restaurants and actually,
it's like I volunteered to be your child.
Yeah. this is the only time that we have, me and my wife, to sit down with the family and to eat, you know, on a Sunday or a Saturday. Now we'll be doing brunch, so maybe Sundays are out for me here, but it's really the only time I can do it. So having, I enjoy breakfast. I think breakfast can be, if not surpass dinner. Unfortunately, the fortunate part about breakfast is it's never that expensive, you know. So you can still get the experience of the chef, and if the chef just uses his mind and creates dinner and does it in everything that he does, that's why I think our banquet menus are going to be phenomenal. Our breakfast menu will be great. Our bar menu is going to be incredible. But just the fact that you can have breakfast and enjoy it and sit down and you know, if you've got 10 minutes for breakfast, we've got an a la carte menu that lets you have the eggs and the bacon and whatever you want to have and just put on a plate. And then we have the specialty breakfast, which will, it's kind of being creative a little bit. You know, like the croque monsieur. I've been thinking about it. You know what I mean? I think I make the best croque monsieur in the country. And that's I'll challenge any Frenchman to it, you know? Mm-hmm. But I'm just thinking about it now, the type of bread that I'm going to buy. I'm thinking I'm going to make it long, and then I'm going to cut holes in it, and I put the eggs in there. I'm going to cook it all at the same time, so it's, and hopefully find the right temperature for it to happen, so the egg's still runny when you cut into it. So I don't know. It's just creating something, making it look different, making it taste the same, so people can identify. So people can identify the flavors and say, well, this is not the craziest thing I've ever tasted. This tastes just like it. But it looks, but it's a different. It's incredible. It's a different way of approaching it. It's deconstructing, to a certain degree. But the lobster's a start, I tell you. It does sound great, doesn't it?
It does. You know, you grew up in Melbourne, and I know that, you know, Australia is noted for its just pristine foodstuffs. I mean, the fact that it's a big island, but it's still an island. So, you Australians have raised a lot of their own meat, you mm-hmm. know, and their own vegetables. So there's really this culture of, you know, fresh and seasonality, whereas mm-hmm. in the United States, it's like something we're trying to create still.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, you know, all chefs care about seasonality and locality, but I wonder if that really influenced you at all growing up in that culture.
Growing up, my parents are Italian. So my grandparents were, you know, they came on the boat and had the parents, you know, my parents with them as children. And, you know, they still lived old school. I mean, when we were kids, I remember going to the farm and my grandma, the whole family's there, because we had eight aunties and uncles on each side of the family. And the whole family goes to this farm and my grandmother picks the pig or the cow, whatever we're going to kill, and then the men go in there and they take, you know, they wrestle it down and do what they got to do, and then, you know, they're bleeding it, and my grandmother would make chocolate out of the blood of the pig. And she's sitting there stirring this thing. I mean, it's probably nasty, but she's stirring the blood so it doesn't coagulate until it cools, and then it stays a liquid, and then she mixes it with all these different things, and, you know, so sure enough,
yeah.
we're rolling truffles and dipping it and all this. And it, you know, I swear to God, if you didn't know it was blood, you'd love it, because you know it's blood, it has a distinct flavor, and so, you know, once you tell people, they shy away from it. But it's absolutely...
Well, there's nothing like a good blood sausage, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, well, that's right. So why not put it in a truffle?
You just call it chocolate.
That's
know?
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. Is the French, you know, it's Boudin Noir. And, mm-hmm. like, you know, if you call it that as opposed to blood sausage, then you're like, oh, yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
I think things are always about what you call them
yeah.
sometimes, you know. It's,
yeah.
That's how people, you know...
I tell you, my parents, you know, we had a big garden in the backyard with the figs and my mother would grow the tomatoes every season. And then sure enough, all the tomatoes were, you know, we collected them all and made a sauce. So, you know, the Italians and the tomato sauce. And, you know, our garage was filled with tomato sauce bottles, you know what I mean? So you never run out of that stuff.
Do you keep up at all with the Australian food scene?
You know, I'm gonna plead ignorance on that one.
Yeah. Were you aware at all of the Robin Wickens, the... I guess he's a chef from Melbourne, and he came to, he stodged here at Alinea.
Did he really?
And then he went back, and he recreated what they were doing at Alinea at his restaurant.
Did he really?
And basically stole every dish, like...
Oh, really?
Like, even, like, the serving pieces and everything.
No way!
Really, yeah, it was, like, sort of a... It's led to this whole thing. Food & Wine did an article on copyright and food, So it was a really interesting thing. It was just, I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that,
Well, I do have thoughts on that. You know, if the chef is, it's a creation. If a chef or a cook, they'll come and work for me, and they're going to learn. And I'm there to teach, you know, but I'm not there. I don't provide college to these guys. They come to cook and they come to learn. They come to cook what Brunacci wants to cook. They don't come to cook. If they came from Alinea, or they're coming from Trotters, and I have the utmost respect for everybody, but it's like when they come into the Brunacci kitchen, they're cooking Brunacci style. And just like I did, you know, everywhere I went, I adapted to what the chef wanted me to do. And then when I became a chef, I'm taking a little bit from everybody, you know what I mean? This is what I want to create, and that's what made me a chef. But to completely steal somebody's idea, and this is the exact menu, and I'm the chef, that blows.
You were 14, I think I read, when you first started cooking, is that right?
Yeah. I was going to school full time.
What were you thinking? Were you just like it seems so young, you know?
Well, I started working when I was 7, in Australia. Yeah. I was delivering. I had two older brothers. The oldest one is 3 years older than me. And as far as I was concerned, I was the same age. So if my brother was doing something at whatever age, I was 3 years younger, I'd do the same thing. So my brother started to paper around or delivering pamphlets when he was 10, and I was 7. I'm like, well, that's what I'm doing too. So I would just follow them, we'd do all that, and you get a 1 cent a pamphlet. So I started working very young. I started cooking in the kitchen and seeing my parents do what they do, and my grandparents. So when I was 14... I wanted, you know, at school I wanted to do a part-time job, and I thought it was a pizza restaurant. It wasn't anything special, but I was only supposed to do the weekends, and it turns out, you know, I was doing such a great job that they said, you know, can you come in and work and work and work? And I'm like, sure, because I was getting paid like $3 an hour, and so that's what I did. And I was spending more time at work than I was at school, even though I was going to school. I was doing both full time, and I was riding my bike at midnight, going home, sleeping until 6 o'clock, getting up, going to school all day, finishing, driving to the pizza shop on my bike, doing the pizza thing for 8 or 10 hours, and going home.
Fully good training, though, right?
It was.
When you get cooking seriously, that's what you're doing anyways.
Well, that's right.
Going into the kitchen.
Well, it doesn't matter. You know what? I swear to God, no matter which kitchen you walk into as a cook, doesn't matter what caliber you're at, you're going to start at the bottom, because until you adapt and get into the speed of the kitchen, I mean, you can't... You're not going to put a guy off the street just on your meat station thinking he's going to do a better job than anybody else. So he's going to be trained, you know.
I read that you worked with Alain Chappelle. Is that...
He was Mietta's in Melbourne was the restaurant. And Alain Chappelle used to come in every year and did like a week's demonstration. So, you know, the clients that we'd have coming in, and, you know, Mietta would go to France and she'd take a chef. You know, Alain Chappelle had come twice. The good thing about that is she would pick her chefs to become her sous chefs and chefs, you know, when she's on her travels. So Jacques Raymond was the chef of the restaurant, but Alain Chappelle was doing the stage. And, you know, so we rolled with his menu for about 2 months after that, after he was there. So it just built this momentum. It was
good for the city. What do you learn from something like that? Do you pick up anything, even in that short time?
You know, at 17... You learn that seriousness, you know, you got to be serious in a serious kitchen.
Yeah, you've worked in some serious kitchens. I wonder, how's your management style? Are you a hardcore guy? Are you a French chef?
No, I don't know. I'm a bit of both, I guess. I'm very strict when it comes to cleanliness, when it comes to focus, when it comes to being clean on the plate. I don't mind if people are talking as long as they're working. I don't like people joking. and as soon as we're done, if the mise en place is done and the whole kitchen is clean and we're waiting for the first ticket to roll on the machine, then yeah, everyone, we huddle in groups and we're joking or whatever, but as soon as that ticket rolls, man, it's action, baby.
Yeah.
You know, we get behind the line, we start cooking it. And it was funny because in New Orleans, I got people... people couldn't understand the fact of how people could be driven by this, but this it's a way of life. I mean, it's a different breed of people. You know, you can be a chef. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I did my apprenticeship and I worked at Mietta's, and I was there for 3 months, and my buddy went to go work for a hotel chain. And it was a good hotel chain. And so we would get together at the end of the week. I'm like, how was your week? And I'm like, man, chef's yelling, chef's kicking, chef's screaming, chef's this. You know, and it's like, man, there's people going crazy over there. He's like, oh, man, we had a ball. The chef was talking about this and that and all this sort of crap. And everyone's laughing and joking, having a good time. I'm like, man, you should ask your chef if there's a place. Yeah, I was very lucky and fortunate. And I think if this didn't happen in my life, I probably wouldn't be here today. He got me a job working in this hotel chain. And the first day I started working there, I knew exactly why the chef was yelling before in my old kitchen. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't serious. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I went from making gourmet cuisine, the best restaurant in probably Australia at the time, to working a cafe and making a tuna sandwich, you know what I mean? Or whatever. And I'm like, man, there's no way to come back. I can't go back now. I'm done. 3 months after that, to the day, the owner of Mietta's called me up to see if I wanted my job back. I'm an apprentice. She's calling me. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, I'll be there in 2 days. I mean, give my 3 days notice. I was done. I mean, it's like, I was very fortunate. And I don't know how she knew that I was thinking about coming back, but I was.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that. I've spoken with a lot of Charlie Trotter's former chefs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of them, you know, they went into that kitchen really young, and, you know, they didn't realize what they were getting into. And after 6 months or a year, they couldn't take it and they left. Mm-hmm. But every single one of those people that I talk to, they all talk about how they either went back or they wanted to go back. Some of them are very successful now on their own, right?
Right.
But they all feel like, I need to go back and prove myself because that was such a good kitchen.
Yeah.
They realized in retrospect.
Well, it's a very serious kitchen. You know? And it's tight, and the crew's fantastic. They're very serious. I was in the kitchen about a week and a half ago. And it is. It's the school that I came from. You know what I mean? So people don't understand. I mean, cooking is a lot of fun, but it's only a lot of fun after you get your job done. You know what I mean? That's when the fun starts. Well, the fun starts from the minute you walk in the door to the end. It just has its valleys and peaks, you know?
There was, I think, at least in the food community here, there were rumors of Robuchon and Alain Ducasse taking this place in the Trump building. Mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, how do you feel about that? Does that validate you? Do you feel like, in some ways, you're rising to that place where you haven't been as a chef, or are you intimidated by that?
I'm not intimidated. Like I said, I think we all execute the same way. I think Ducasse and Robuchon, you know, they have a lot more punch than I have. Or pulling punch. You know, if he says I need 50 cooks in the kitchen, he's going to get 50. If I say I need 50, they're going to laugh at me. Mm-hmm. But if I had 50, I could do the same stuff, you know what I mean? I'm not saying he's got 50 over there. But, you know, this is a time for me to enjoy and actually, for the first time in my life, have the opportunity to excel. So I don't take it lightly. When I look at that building, I just shivers, and the hair on the back of my neck just stands up, you know, and I know that my name's behind this project. And if I didn't cook the way I did at my tasting, and that's how I cook, and I wasn't really cooking at 100% because I'm by myself and I'm cooking for four guys and I'm executing everything and doing everything in a couple of days, so it was pretty tough. But you know, with the brigade behind you finish it cleaner, it's nicer, it's delicate, you know, the foams are foam, this is everything's, it is the way it's supposed to be. I think what I focused on my tasting was I'm focusing on the marriage and the execution. You know, the presentation, you can't really do that much when you're by yourself. So you know, I can hang with the best of them, I think, you know, as long as we're serious about the whole situation. My team, I'm only as good as the team that I hire. It's tough to find good cooks, you know what I mean? Everybody wants to hold on to them. So it doesn't matter what I offer, they go back, give their notice. If they're that great, the other guy's going to do what it takes to keep them. I'm privileged and honored for the opportunity, and I don't fail, you know what I mean? And I refuse to even put that in my context of speech.
So the restaurant's going to be named 16, right? Mm-hmm. It's on the 16th floor. One of the things I read, you know, it said no detail has been overlooked. I wondered if there's some really interesting things that you guys have already thought about that, you know, you could talk about.
I think the 30-foot ceilings. So when you're sitting, you're probably sitting at 4 feet tall, and you got 30-foot windows, and you got the clock towers right there. You got this beautiful wine, as you walk in the entrance, and when you open and get out of the elevator, there's this wine room that's glassed, encased, 1,000 bottles. And you walk through the wine room to walk into the restaurant, and then you're encompassed by this amazing room that's filled with a lot of glass, a lot of metal. I think they were saying it's like a 20-foot chandelier. Don't quote me on that one because I'm not 100%, but it's, I've only seen CGIs. And because of that, I've walked the space a couple of times, but when you're in it and you see what you see, and this is, we're talking bare construction, I'm overwhelmed by seeing it in that sense. I can just imagine what it's going to look like when it's actually, you know, completely decked out. The plates are coming from a place in Greece. It's going to have a glass element to all our base plates and our tabletop presentation. So our Czech presenter is going to be glass. Our votive is limestone and glass. Our the flowers encased in the same thing, so they're a matching pair. So we're going to have this glass element on the tabletop. Our sugar presenter is all in glass. So it's going to have this glass element, and then it's all Bernardo china. Everything's on Bernardo, and then I'm buying specialty plates as well. But no, it's inspiring. You know, when you walk in, it needs to be welcoming. You know, it needs to be, because it's a hotel restaurant, and the stigma for hotel restaurants at this sort of level, you only find them at the Ritz-Carlton Four Seasons. You know what I mean? So
except for Avenues and the Peninsula, really, I think they buck that trend of the hotel restaurant. I think they have their own personality.
They do.
Interesting.
We look at Nomi as one of those hotel restaurants that offer an a la carte. We're actually going to do the a la carte, and we're going to offer a tasting menu.
I think the chef there, Christophe David, I just think he's sort of, he's really brought sort of that Michelin 3-star spirit to Nomi.
Yeah.
That didn't, you know, I mean, Charlie Trotter's has always been about excellence, and there's been a few restaurants in the city, but I felt like when I dined there, that was the first time I said, you know, I could feel like I was in Europe, you know, as opposed to necessarily here in Chicago, which was interesting.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I love that restaurant. I think I've been there 3 times. I love the space. I've been there for brunch now. And maybe it's more because, you know, when they tell me who do we want to be, you know, Nomi comes up a lot because it has the hotel element to it, you know, and it's a fancy designed restaurant. They're going to be not competing spaces, you know, but we've got the same element. We're up above. You actually have to go in there and go to a different level and get, you know, it was tough to be in New Orleans in a hotel restaurant because we'd be empty. You know what I mean? The lobby is the only thing that got any traffic. You know what I mean? So this has to have a freestanding feel to it. We have to embrace differently. We're not going to, you know, even though we put our efforts together, you know, 16 is going to stand apart, and it has to. Otherwise, we're going to have the stigma, and I don't want that stigma.
A lot of chefs talk about the interplay of their food with the space and how that's kind of important. I wonder, you know, looking at the CGI and looking at the space, you said you were kind of inspired by it. How does that impact your food at all? Do you think of plating in a different way, or do you, you know, how you combine ingredients?
Well, a little bit, but I think the space, the location, the other people that are in the city, who I am as a chef, I think all I need to do is the best I can do. Mm-hmm. And if I do that, I got a winning chemistry. A lot of times people are going to come out, they want this one, that. And if you have this never say no attitude, you'll be successful. You know, we're going to have, you know, it's not a Ritz-Carlton or a Four Seasons or a Peninsula. This is Trump Towers. You know, this is, everybody knows who Mr. Trump is. This whole country, there's 300 million people here. I guarantee you, maybe 50 million people know a Ritz-Carlton or about the Ritz-Carlton. But 300 million people know exactly who Mr. Trump is, and they're going to want to see what the hell we're doing over there. You know what I mean? So we want to make sure that we're embracing everybody, because everybody will be coming to this hotel just to check us out. You know what I mean? And they'll know that if they want to come have a steak, it's going to be, you know, at Mr. Trump's restaurant. And that's, I think, what they're going to think.
What does it mean to work with the Trump team? I mean, does that, you know, I'm sure they demand excellence, you know, but does it empower you in certain ways?
It's inspiring, to say the least. I mean, I interviewed Mr. Trump, and I'm lucky enough to be one of two that hired in the whole Chicago hotel. So being in his office, man, I talk about nerves.
We in New York.
I did my tasting here to the contingency over here, and I was the candidate they put forward to New York. And so they called me up to go to New York, and I met with the CEO of the hotels first, and then I met with the kids. And there was no talk of me meeting Mr. Trump, and I'm there with Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric, and then Ivanka picks up the phone, and she's like, Dad, do you want to meet the candidate? And as soon as she said, Dad, and she said, okay, she goes, sure, okay, and got off the phone, that's when I got really, really nervous in the interview. And I'm just like, man, you know, you see him every day. You see him every day or every week. You know, The Apprentice watch it all the time. So, I mean, knowing who he is, what he can do, and especially what he can do for somebody, the scope of it is incredible. But they are the nicest people I think I've ever met in my life.
Did he give you any advice or any sort of like cautionary, like this is what you need to think about, or is he, you know, or is he pretty hands off in that sense?
I mean, he said make people happy. You know, I mean, you make people happy, people are going to come back. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, ideally, that's the winning formula in any recipe in any restaurant. So, you know, he knows we're going to be one of the top hotels in this city, and they're hiring everybody to make that happen. So it's.
Do you get nervous when you watch him on The Apprentice? He's like your
favorite. No. he told me he did the arm thing. He did the "you're hired" to me. He said, "I like this guy. You're hired." You know, it's something. It was surreal. It was out of body. It was amazing. And I swear to God, my dying days, I'll remember it. You know what I mean? I'll be telling my grandkids about it, you know?
Did you guys talk about anything that was really interesting, or was there, like, a story there?
No, it's...
It's just more about you being nervous and...
Yeah, well, I mean, seriously, I was sitting there, and it was everybody was in the office, and there was other people in there, and, I mean, Mr. Trump's mind is supernatural. I mean, it's going 100 miles an hour. He would ask me a question, and I would answer that question, and then it would trigger something in his mind about what he's been thinking about. And then he turned to one of the kids and said, how's that thing going if I just said golf? He said, well, how's that golf course going? You know, so it was an amazing, it was out of body. All I could do was sit there, smile, looking at Mr. Trump. I looked at him the whole time, and he turned to me a couple of times and smiled back, and it was amazing.
Has he tasted your food yet?
He hasn't, no.
No. Do you know, is there something that he really likes that you'll cook for him, or that you know he might have some proclivities?
I've been told what Joe Isidori, who's our corporate VP of food and beverage, and the chef at Trump Vegas, used to work one-on-one with Mr. Trump. So he's told me a couple of things that I need to watch out for. So, but I think during the opening, whenever I cook for Mr. Trump, I hope Joe's with me. I'll be calling Joe on the phone.
Nothing you can share, though?
No, not unless I get the green light.
All right, understood. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, no worries.
Thanks for listening to Chefs on the Grill. If you have any feedback, please send me an email at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. And in the meantime, stay hungry.